we're right on time. Thank you for being here early so that we can get our last oral argument case ready to go. I'll give you time to get set up. Reminder, each of you has 15 minutes for presentation of your case. 5 minutes is reserved to appellate counsel for rebuttal. Please indicate your name and the client you're speaking on behalf of for our recording purposes. I will ask our marshal to call the last case.
Calling case number 8-230779, State versus Jackson.
Take your time.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Julie Nelson, and I represent the appellant Rodney Jackson in his appeal from his Hennepin County conviction for second-degree intentional murder. This case is back before this court after remand to the district court for a partial redo of a Schwartz hearing. This court has two issues to decide. First, did the district court abuse its discretion when it found that the verdict was not impacted by the extraneous information that juror MH inserted into the deliberations about what Jackson would have known and or should have known based on his conceal and carry training. Secondly, this court must decide whether MH's testimony at the second Schwartz hearing was materially different from her prior statements, making remand for another Schwartz hearing involving the other 10 jurors necessary. And just to take a minute, I'd like to remind this court exactly what statement, what happened that triggered all these Schwartz hearings to begin with. It was based on a jury evaluation that juror MH sent into the court, and in the response to how could the prosecution have improved its case, the juror said, it should have presented info on the conceal and carry responsibility of self-defense, should have explained what Jackson would have learned in conceal and carry class regarding Minnesota law about obligation to retreat. This jury was going for self-defense and not guilty before I shared what's taught in permit class. MH was essentially, for lack of a better word, bragging that she flipped the juror by telling them about conceal and carry law.
And all of this was elicited, all of this information and that timing that you described was elicited during the first round of Schwartz hearings.
Correct.
And then the second round of Schwartz hearings, she comes back and says, we talked about it after we signed the verdict form.
Correct.
So I agree with you that there is a difference in the testimony between hearing number one and hearing number two, but I'm struggling to determine how that difference is material such that in a way that we need to bring back the other 10 jurors. It seems like it only gets worse for your client based on hearing number two, that all of the good stuff that would warrant the new trial came out already at hearing number one. So why is it material for the new trial motion?
Well, it's material because of this. I think, you know, first of all, let's look at the reason why this court said to only bring back the two jurors that had testified during the closed hearing. Brought them back because we wanted to have the open hearing. The idea was that if they testified differently, then that would have impacted the questions that would have been asked by the other jurors and their answers. So, for example, if MH had testified at the first Schwartz hearing, hey, I never said any of this until after the verdict had been reached, you can bet that the following jurors, 10 jurors, would have been asked, when during deliberations did this occur? And then what their answers might have been. That would have been a different testimony. This is the exact same reason that the U.S. Supreme Court and Waller said we're just going to redo the pretrial suppression hearing to see for the closed part and see if the witnesses testifies materially differently. Because again, that could impact the rest of the testimony. That's why this needs to be redone. We need to find out what they're going to say. Is it going to hurt my client? I don't know that for a fact. But we need to find this out. I would concede that if everybody comes and says, hey, this conversation happened after the verdict, then clearly it didn't impact it. But I don't think that we have that.
My read of the new trial order that was issued by the judge, which was reaffirmed after the second Schwartz hearing, is that she assumed that the improper statements were made during deliberations. So I'm still struggling. I mean, when I read the remand instruction from the Supreme Court, it starts off with Jackson has not shown why it would be necessary to repeat the testimony from the 10 unaffected jurors. So given that the district court assumed, as I read it at least, that the improper information was elicited during deliberations, what is to be gained by bringing back the other 10 jurors at this point?
Well, I think, Your Honor, we need to talk about what does it mean to be materially different, and I think that that goes to whether or not the Cox factors are being impacted by this new testimony, right? So, first of all, the district court did not make any findings specifically as to when this occurred. All she said was it was an expansion of the prior testimony. So that would almost suggest that she say, no, it did happen after the verdict was reached. Well, we don't know that. See, I don't know if you understand what I'm saying. So it's not just she didn't make a finding that the she made no explicit finding as to when this occurred. She said that MH's testimony that this conversation happened after the verdict was reached and the verdict form was signed was an expansion of what she had previously said. So she was therefore adopting that statement.
Just zoom out a little bit here?
Sure.
I'd like to talk about the comment itself and maybe explore why you're alleging it was so prejudicial. I mean, if we look at the comment itself, this juror, even assuming the truth of everything she said, she alleged that she had educated the jury about what she learned in her conceal and carry class and suggested that because there was evidence that Mr. Jackson had such a permit, he would have learned the same stuff. And that stuff included a duty to retreat. Given that the jury was also given a self-defense instruction, which included, instruction on a defendant's duty to retreat, how is that even prejudicial?
Okay. The reason it's prejudicial is because, well, MH's comments about what Jackson should have known or learned in conceal and carry is different than what the actual court's instruction was on self-defense. For example, she said, "It's very dangerous to ever use your weapon because it will be held against you many times, even if you try to use it for good purposes." That was MH's comment to the rest of the jurors. Now, that negates the use of self-defense to protect yourself or others, because you can use self-defense for that reason. And she's saying, even if you want to use it for a good reason like that, you're going to get in trouble for it. She also makes this, she lowers the standard for self-defense is lower than what MH said it was. She says, it would be because, this is what she testified to at the first hearing, it would be because you feel like your life is absolutely threatened and you didn't have any other option. That is not the standard for self-defense. The standard for self-defense is that you reasonably believed that you were exposed or that someone else was exposed to death or great bodily harm. She reiterated her understanding of that at the second hearing when she said, you only use your gun if you have if it's your life or their life. Again, that is not the standard, but that was MH's understanding of when to use conceal and carry, when you can use your gun if you have a conceal and carry permit. It is a very high standard. And that simply is not the standard that the self-defense instruction that the court gave requires. It's a lower standard. And so while they both talk about, as you said, the when to use it and the duty to retreat, MH distorted that.
I guess I'm confused by if she was providing a different standard than that contained in the jury instructions, how the jury would have been swayed by that as opposed to the instructions which they all said during the Schwartz hearing they followed.
Well, two things. I don't think they, frankly, all said that they followed it. But even if they did, that's not the determination that is made during a Schwartz hearing. It's not a matter of whether they followed the instructions. They certainly could have followed the instructions. But the question is whether or not that extraneous information then impacted the verdict, and it could have impacted it by their understanding of the court's instruction. By saying, hey, no, this is a really high standard. Jackson did not have a right to use the gun under those circumstances. He had a conceal and carry permit. It separated him almost from everyone else, from anyone else who doesn't have a conceal and carry permit. If she had not said those things out loud or just thought them to herself, or if Jackson did not have a conceal and carry permit, the jury would have just focused on...
Are you saying that information, are you saying it change their understanding or their awareness of what the jury, what the court's instructions were, the jury instructions?
The question is, did it impact it? And yes, it did. It could have impacted it, and we know that because that's what she said in her written statement. This jury was going to acquit until I brought up the conceal and carry standard. That's what she said. So we know that it impacted the verdict. We know that it impacted their understanding of the self-defense instruction.
Well, we know that because she said it in her jury questionnaire. Mm-hmm. It got a little watered down, wouldn't you agree?
Yes.
During the first Schwartz hearing, and then
maybe even more during the second Schwartz hearing.
Yes, it did.
And the testimony at the Schwartz hearing was under oath, unlike the allegation made mm-hmm. in the questionnaire. So what is the hard body of evidence that we're looking at here when we're evaluating the district court's application of its discretion?
Well, so the statement that she made in the questionnaire is part of the record. The court never found that it wasn't credible. The court only found that what she said in the second hearing was an expansion of what she had already said, and I think that we have to, you cannot reconcile the first written statement with what she said later. You simply cannot reconcile those two. The jury was going to acquit until I said this, and then that was her written statement, and then that last statement was, nothing happened until after the verdict. So you can't reconcile those two. So it could not have been an expansion. But the court never discredited MH's first statement. Secondly, if you want to look at it, no, it was not an under oath. It was hearsay, right? But that doesn't mean that we don't consider it. We consider things like excited utterance and present sense impression. And we give credit to statements made in those situations because they are made close in time to the event, and there's nothing that outside factor that influenced the statement. And that's why that statement needs to be given credit. There is nothing to discredit it. So then the question, you look at this and go, well, then why did she water it down? Well, perhaps because she knew she had done something wrong and she was concerned.
Or because she was puffing in the questionnaire. Or because she was bragging in the questionnaire and exaggerating maybe her importance in the process. I mean, I think there are sort of two ways to look at it, right? So that's why the Schwartz hearing testimony is so important.
Right, and there were also some other witness or other jurors that testified at the first Schwartz hearing that volunteered, we followed the court's instruction and we brought in just information that, you know, we were told we could bring in our own personal information. It was very interesting wording that two of the jurors used, and John Conard, who was the trial attorney, made a record that when these jurors made those statements, they were a bit sheepish when they were doing it, as though they were trying to backtrack and make sure that they hadn't done anything wrong. So I think that you can also take that into this, and that would that also weighs into MH was trying to undo any damage that she thinks she may have done by bringing this information in the first place.
One other thing I'm hoping you can help me with, is, you know, we're not viewing all of this in a vacuum.
Right.
We're viewing it in conjunction with the evidence that was actually presented to the jury, and that evidence included the videos, which, you know, the jury had the opportunity to watch, and the forensic evidence, which included the fact that the victim was shot in the back of the head. And so how, in the context of you know, the full evidence of the trial, was anything that this juror may have said prejudicial?
Sure. So you're talking about the third Cox factor, which is the weight of the evidence. Okay. Which is not a sufficiency of the evidence standard, but just the weight of the evidence. So This was not a close call, as the district court claimed. The jurors were very interested in reviewing those videos. They actually asked several times, can we get up and get closer to the screen? They were very concerned about what was shown, what was proved, what wasn't. And so there was a question about what Jackson had seen or what he thought he would have seen. The comments that MH made, again, in the context of Jackson having a concealed carry and creating a higher standard for him, you don't shoot your gun unless your life, it's your life or their life, that absolutely would impact his self-defense claim. So his claim for self-defense did not get the jury was not allowed to look at that, or he did not have the opportunity to have the jury review his self-defense claim in those terms as it should have, because it was tainted by this, Jackson has a higher standard because he had a conceal and carry permit. And I see that I am just about out of time. Thank you.
You'll have rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. Your Honors, my name is Brittany Lawana, and I'm a senior assistant Hennepin County attorney appearing on behalf of the respondent, the state of Minnesota. Counsel said that there's nothing to discredit the statement that was in the jury questionnaire. I think there is. There's the juror's sworn testimony. I think that she provides context to the statement that she made. And Judge Gatiss, I agree with you. I think she's puffing in it. I think she's bragging about her importance, and I don't think that is the standard that we apply. That's why we have a Schwartz hearing. And the test actually is to a hypothetical jury. And I think the first Schwartz hearing gave us a lot of answers that weren't solicited by the parties. The court was careful not to ask questions like, did that impact your verdict? That was volunteered by people. But turning it to a hypothetical jury with the Cox factors, I don't think that the district court abused its discretion here to deny the motion for a new trial. I also don't think that there's a material difference. I think it is an expansion or a clarification when MH gives the timing of her statement with regard to when she brought up the conceal and carry. If you look at the transcript...
I mean, yes. I don't know how you reconcile the question during the first Schwartz hearing of, did you have these discussions during deliberation? And she says yes. And then in the second Schwartz hearing, she says it was after we signed the verdict form, which is... by definition, not while they're deliberating, because they've completed their deliberations. So I don't know how you reconcile those things.
Well, Your Honor, we know what the definition of deliberations is. And I think attorneys and judges can put a line on, after you've signed the verdict, you're no longer deliberating. I don't know that that's what she understood it to mean. So I don't think that it's as significant in that sense. I think that even if it was brought up in the context of deliberations, it still was... basically an explanation and further information about the duty to retreat and the duty of self-defense. And so even if it was during deliberations, even if she meant that it was during deliberations initially, I don't think that that's as problematic as counsel does. I would note, I find it interesting that in State versus Lopez, granted it's completely in a footnote and it's not at all binding. There's a comment from the Minnesota Supreme Court in a 2023 decision that this was merely just a recitation of the self-defense case law. So the Supreme Court, which has heard this case, notes that, which I know it's not binding. It was interesting to me.
I'm struggling a little bit with our original decision in the case and then the Supreme Court's decision as to what constitutes a material difference, because it's not defined. Do you want to comment on that?
I would have loved a definition. I think that would have been helpful. I think any of us would have been pleased with that. I don't think...
Material to what is my question. What are we looking for here?
I think it's materially different. Material to whether it completely changes the testimony that was given in the closed session. That's how I would look at it. Because it is essentially a redo of the portion that was closed. This is to make sure that it's in open court and that it's not unavailable to the public. If you look at those statements, I don't think that it is materially different. It may expand a bit. It may clarify a bit. Perhaps also her memory is different. We're talking about something that happened. She initially testified, I think it was December 31st, 2019, and then comes back in May of 2023. COVID happened during that. That's a lot that has happened in that sense. And so I think that's kind of the problem with going back and asking people to talk about what did or didn't happen. And
can I just ask, along the lines of, you know, what did we mean when we said materially different? What did we mean when we said should? Is that something that is subject to the abuse of discretion standard too, whether the judge should have had a Schwartz hearing involving the other 10 jurors?
It's not the same as must. It's not the same as may. It's probably to the discretion of the district court, I think.
So is that some, you know, is the district court's decision not to call in the 10 jurors a question that is part of our determination as to whether the district court abused its discretion here?
I think it can be, but I think that's entitled to deference. I think that the standard of review is abuse of, I believe the standard of review is abuse of discretion. And there's case law that talks about how to handle the Schwartz hearing itself is largely to the discretion of the district court. And I think here, Judge Catherine Quaintance, who had been on the bench for 30 years, heard this, didn't think it was materially different, and chose not to call the other 10 back. I don't think she would have hesitated to do so. She brought in a juror from, on order obviously from the Supreme Court and this court, she brought in a juror from Texas to come in and testify. I think this is a homicide case with a lot of implications, and I would hope that it would not be treated lightly, and I don't think that it was here. As someone who participated in the Schwartz hearing, there were questions that were answered, there were questions that were posed but not answered, and I think all the parties understood the significance of this and that it wasn't just for show. I do think, too, the jury is presumed to follow the court's instructions. And so the jury was correctly instructed on self-defense, on the duty to retreat, and also that they can use their common sense and life experiences. Transcript page 1048, jurors may rely on their own experience, good judgment, and common sense. It's possible that a hypothetical juror would have taken this as someone talking about their life experiences and things that they've learned in classes that they've taken.
What about Ms. Nelson's argument that actually what this juror did was inject a sort of higher standard that Mr. Jackson would have been subjected to, and, you know, effectively changing the self-defense instruction?
I don't think the juror did. I think the wording of what the juror is saying here, we don't have a transcript of what she said in the deliberations. We don't have a transcript of what she said in the jury room. So I don't know how much weight to give to the fact that she says you absolutely have to fear for your life. I don't know. I think it's difficult. If we're going to parse the words, I'd rather have a transcript, which I know we obviously don't have one from deliberations or in the jury room. But I don't think it's a higher weight. But even if it is, the right standard was there, and you had unsolicited testimony from some other jurors that they followed the judge's instructions, that they followed what they were told, and there's case law that this court presumes the jury followed the instructions. So if one juror goes amiss and says, oh, but I think you really, really have to be afraid, it can't just be reasonably afraid, if that juror says that, the jury's still presumed to follow those instructions.
The question was asked of Ms. Nelson, and not by me, but I'd like to have you answer also how we coordinate all of this with the fact that there was the video evidence and the forensics that the victim was shot in the back of the head.
Well, I think that's definitely something that you take into consideration under the Cox factors. Talking about, at least I thought it was, maybe not, weight of evidence properly before a jury, that's what I'm looking at. This is a very strong case. You have video evidence of the defendant and his girlfriend, Miss Leek, leaving the scene, coming back to the scene, Miss Leek exiting the vehicle, initiating the fight with Mr. Abdi by throwing something at him. Mr. Abdi throws some rocks back, then turns around, and Miss Leek is running toward the vehicle when the defendant fires. And I think he bragged about what a good shot he was when he was talking to the police. And then they leave. They don't stop to see if it's okay. They don't stop to give an explanation for self-defense. They go to a movie. So I think the evidence was pretty strong, and the fact that the jury wanted to watch the video, we can't read into why they wanted to watch the video. If there's video evidence, I would hope they'd want to see it again instead of just the first time, but that doesn't mean that they were questioning it. It doesn't mean that they were buying the defense argument that there was a gun on Mr. Abdi. That was not supported by the record at all. In fact, the lead investigator testified, it's transcript 1009, that there was no evidence to support the defense theory that Mr. Abdi had a gun or Mr. Jackson thought he had a gun. And there was no evidence to support anything that someone had removed a gun from him when they came to the scene. And so I think the jury did a thorough job by looking at the evidence and looking at everything in front of them, but it's a strong case. And so I think the weight of the evidence properly before the jury weighs against finding that the district court should have reversed and granted a new trial. So I think that that's a factor that has to be looked at heavily. Also, if you look at the factors that do go for granting a new trial, such as the likelihood that curative measures were effective, which obviously that couldn't happen here because it was after the verdict was received. There's case law that factor is not intended to be to consider whether it's prejudicial or not. The same is also true of the number of jurors exposed weighing in favor of a trial, but that also doesn't consider the conclusions that the jury drew. And looking at, there's an unprecedented case from this court that I think is helpful, Malik. It's 2019 Westlaw 1104820. It's cited in my brief. That case talks about looking at the hypothetical jury and what would or would not come into play. So even if this court, even if the district court considered that the jury, what this jury heard and what this jury shouldn't have heard, this court can still sit and look at what a hypothetical jury did. So this court could disagree with the district court and still apply that standard based on the information in front of it. And this court could determine that it doesn't mandate a reversal because, as Cox has noted, just because that information is there doesn't automatic, it's not structural error. It doesn't amount to an automatic reversal. And I think here on this record, I think the juror was puffing. I think that the statement was not materially different. It was a little different, but I don't think it shifts it to the point where we're going to completely upend the trial, call in 10 more jurors. And so I would respectfully ask that this court affirm the district court's order denying the new trial and affirm the district court's decision not to recall those 10 jurors. I have additional time, but if there are no further questions, I would rest on my brief.
It appears not. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.